You're listening to Healing Through Prayer with Corrine Walson on PLIR, Prayerful Living Internet Radio. Now here's your host, Corrine Walson.
Welcome everybody to Healing Through Prayer. Today's topic, no sympathy with error. Does the Bible ever describe Jesus as asking a person how he or she got their ailment or condition? Did he question them about their personal history or even their parents' medical history? Did he ever say or do anything that indicated shock or sadness over the situation? No. But what Jesus did have was compassion. Compassion is not the same as sympathy, although I did find some dictionaries that list them as synonymous. Sympathy is defined as feelings of pity and sorrow for someone else's misfortune. And this implies that one first recognizes that another has experienced actual misfortune and then commiserates with the unfortunate one. Compassion, on the other hand, means to love or to free from suffering. I found one definition that gave to speak on behalf of. And I love that because it accurately describes what Jesus did for those who came to him seeking help. There are many references where the Bible describes that just before Jesus healed, he had, quote, great compassion upon them. Jesus felt great love for the children of Israel, the lost sheep without a shepherd, who had not been given the laws of truth and love, and were suffering needlessly. Jesus never accepted the outward manifestation of any sickness or form of suffering. He only saw the perfect son or daughter of God, only was conscious of their inherent freedom and exemption from the laws of matter. And this conviction of the truth is what drove out the darkness in the man or woman's thought, which is the only place sickness or suffering ever actually exists. Jesus advocated or argued on the side of truth for those seeking healing. If Jesus had been impressed by what he saw, it would have been game over. If he had sympathized with the so-called afflicted, he would have walked right into the dream state along with the suffering and would have been of no use to him or her. But Jesus was the perfect embodiment of the Christ, or truth, and he came so that we too would know this truth that sets us free from all forms of erroneous thinking and consequent suffering. So from this we know that we too must not entertain any sympathy with error, false thoughts, limiting thoughts, that we don't accept anything less than the truth into our consciousness. Mary Baker Eddy wrote in Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, "Stand porter at the door of thought." Admitting only such conclusions as you wish realized in bodily results, you will control yourself harmoniously. When the condition is present which you say induces disease, whether it be air, exercise, heredity, contagion, or accident, then perform your office as porter and shut out these unhealthy thoughts and fears. Exclude from mortal mind the offending errors. Then the body cannot suffer from them. The issues of pain or pleasure must come through mind, and like a watchman forsaking his post, we admit the intruding belief, forgetting that through divine help we can forbid this entrance. The body seems to be self-acting only because mortal mind is ignorant of itself, of its own actions, and of its results, ignorant that the predisposing, remote, and exciting cause of all bad effects is the law of so-called mortal mind, not of matter. Mind, capital M, a name for God, is the master of the corporeal senses and can conquer sin, sickness, and death. Exercise this God-given authority. Take possession of your body and govern its feeling and action. Rise in the strength of truth to resist all that is unlike good. God has made man capable of this, and nothing can vitiate the ability and power divinely bestowed on man. So if whatever makes us suffer can only manifest itself if it first takes residency in our thoughts, then it is at the level of thought that all salvation rests. We've got to be vigilant about what we accept into our thinking, for ourselves and others. We need to have zero tolerance for anything that does not reflect God's love. This means when we're tempted to see something about or in another and are tempted to rush in to fix or solve or commiserate with them about their misfortune or so-called condition, we must stop right there and recognize that we are being tempted to accept as real that which is not. And that if we accept the situation or condition as real, we are actually condemning and injuring the one we would rescue. We are making the condition real. We are walking into the dream state right along with the other person, and we've then become totally useless and incapable of helping them. Let me give you a couple examples in my own life. My daughter attended a private high school in St. Louis, and I'd received a call that she'd injured her ankle while playing soccer. She'd been seen by the school nurse and that she'd been given a pair of crutches. She was upset because there was an important game that she needed to play the next day. Immediately when I heard this, for a split second, I was tempted to become fearful, allow the what ifs to enter my thinking, and to be sympathetic for her and her situation. But hot on the heels of that thought was, this isn't real. As a spiritual idea, there can be no accident, trauma, pain, brokenness, fracture. I knew in that moment that the human picture had never actually made contact with her real identity, and I just dismissed it. That was on a Wednesday, and that night I went to church where we have Wednesday evening testimony meetings, and I stood up and I gave thanks in advance for the healing that I knew had already taken place and said how excited I was that I was going to hear from my daughter about her healing. In other words, I gave thanks in advance of the already present fact of my daughter's perfection. The next day, my daughter joyously called to tell me that she had never had to use the crutches and was able to play in Thursday's game. I had refused to accept the lie of accident and held fast to the truth that divine mind governs its ideas harmoniously and perfectly, and gave gratitude as further evidence of this truth as present fact. This insisting on the presence and power of truth freed not only myself, but my daughter as well. If I'd reacted fearfully, I would have walked right into the dream with her and would have done a great disservice to her. Another example, I had moved up to the local mountains and it had recently snowed. My mom was helping me and we were in the process of moving things from a moving truck into my new place. There was snow on the ground, and apparently some ice had formed on the stairs going down to the front door. I was at the moving truck, and I picked up a box and was headed back when I stopped at the top of the steps. I looked down and saw my mom lying on the ground in a fetal position. I sucked in my breath as I looked at her, and then it was like I had been pulled back and was looking at the scene from a distance, or like it was on a movie screen, and very authoritatively I heard, "That is not real." A calm settled over me, and I walked down to her and declared to her that she was all right. My mom is a Christian Science practitioner, and she immediately agreed with me that she was, and that she was not a victim of a fall. As I tried to help her up, she started to slide around a little bit, and we both started giggling. This totally broke the illusion and atmosphere of fear and concern. I felt it just lift. You know, the ego wants us fearful to start going down the road of gloom and doom, stories of how this could be serious and about age, broken bones, etc. The seed of fear is planted and we just water the heck out of it with our fears. Well, my mom stood up and we continued unpacking the truck. When we were done, we started to make our way back to her car to go get something to eat. I noticed that my mom was limping a little and I told her that she was and that because there'd never been a real accident, there could therefore be no evidence of any accident. My mom said, "Oh, excuse me," and began walking without any difficulty. From that moment on, there was not evidence of or even discussion about what clearly had not taken place. I can feel that some of you may be tempted to think that this is just mind over matter. If you're tempted to think that the human mind, with a little m, is influencing the situation, this is incorrect. If you are starting with the premise that it is the divine mind, with a capital M, a synonym for God, you are correct. God, divine mind, created the universe and everything in it. He's the only creator and only power. God doesn't just create and then walk off the job. He preserves, maintains, sustains, governs, directs all his ideas harmoniously forever. You will never be and cannot be outside of his direct influence and perfect government. The real man is forever held and cared for by his father, mother. Knowing this, it can be seen that man can never fall, never be in an accident, never leave the perfect and harmonious influence of God's presence. When you cling to these truths, right in the face of what seems to be an accident or mishap, you nullify mortal mind's attempt at creation. When I declared that my daughter and my mother could not experience anything other than God's loving care, and that anything trying to convince me of the opposite was unreal, the results were immediate. This truth was the light that dispelled the darkness, the lie called accident. In each situation, the Holy Spirit was right with me and immediately instructed me on how not to be sympathetic to the material picture, but to declare and insist on the truth of our being, our at-one-ment with God, the unfallen, perfect status of all of God's children. It was a radical stance in the face of what appeared to be alarming, and the truth drove off the darkness, the belief in error. Yes, we see accidents on TV. Yes, you've probably experienced them yourself, and what I'm sharing might seem dubious to you. The world is mortal mind's playground and movie screen. If you look to it for your source of truth about you and others, you will be fortified with pictures of fear, scarcity, sickness, sin, hatred, cruelty, abuse, accidents, catastrophes. I am asking you to consider that these pictures are false, that they are the outward manifestation of fearful and limited thinking, that the awful scenes are projections of a so-called mind apart from God, which cannot be real because God is the only mind there is. How do I know that what we are seeing that seems so real and calls for our sympathy isn't real? Because a declaration and knowledge of the truth cancels out the offensive picture or condition. If this wasn't so, Jesus couldn't have healed a lame man. Peter could not have raised the dead girl. The blind man would not have been healed, and the lepers would not have been cleansed. These so-called miracles occurred because truth was applied right where error tried to assert itself. Can you imagine what would have happened if Peter actually saw the young girl as dead? If he had accepted that picture as true, he would not have been able to raise her. Once we have sympathy with and stand in agreement with the false picture, we're doomed. Not only have we become unable to assist the other, but our agreement with the false condition serves to convict the person we would help, adding to their affliction and predicament. Again, we must have no sympathy with error. If a child were to write 2 + 2 = 5 on a sheet of paper, we wouldn't sit with them and say, "Oh, that's too bad. That's just awful. You'll never get it right. You know, I did that once too. I'm so sorry." No, we would not be in sympathy with the erroneous concept, but we would, however, out of compassion for the child, reason with them and teach them the truth of mathematics, help them to see the correct way of adding, and rejoice with them as they applied the law of math to the problem and came away with the correct conclusion. Do you recall the story of Peter and John and the lame man? In Acts chapter 3, verse 2, it reads, "Now Peter and John went up together into the temple at the hour of prayer, being the ninth hour. And a certain man lame from his mother's womb was carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple, which is called Beautiful, to ask alms of them that entered into the temple. Who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked an alms. And Peter, fastening his eyes upon him with John, said, 'Look on us.' And he gave heed unto them, expecting to receive something of them. Then Peter said, 'Silver and gold have I none, but such as I have give I thee. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk.' And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. And he, leaping up, stood and walked and entered with them into the temple, walking and leaping and praising God. Peter and John did not give the man money, i.e., sympathy for his seeming condition, but instead they had compassion on him, uttered the truth on his behalf, and their understanding and conviction of the truth of his inherent freedom healed him. He was physically and mentally lifted up. He was shown the truth of his invulnerability, his complete exemption from man's so-called health laws and laws of heredity, and he jumped up leaping and joyful. It didn't take time for truth to be true. It doesn't take time for two and two to be four. It already is. We just need to understand and declare it to experience it. Cool, huh? We need to take as aggressive a stance against serpent talk, mortal mind's attempt at getting us to accept the false picture, as we do against bullies at school, against an unfair parking ticket or a false accusation. You need to get up and argue on the side of good God. Science and Health states that Jesus uncovered and rebuked sin before he cast it out. Of a sick woman, he said that Satan had bound her. And to Peter, he said, "Thou art an offense unto me." He came teaching and showing men how to destroy sin, sickness, and death. He said of the fruitless tree, "It is hewn down." It is believed by many that a certain magistrate who lived at the time of Jesus left this record, "His rebuke is fearful." The strong language of our master confirms this description. The only civil sentence which he had for error was, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Still stronger evidence that Jesus' reproof was pointed and pungent is found in his own words, showing the necessity for such forcible utterance when he cast out devils and healed the sick and sinning. The relinquishment of error deprives material sense of its false claims. Likewise, we must argue on the side of truth. Assert your God-given dominion, your spiritual substance, your right to absolute freedom from all forms of suffering. Zero tolerance is our new motto. We create a law unto ourselves. If it isn't of God, if it isn't loving or isn't good, it's out. All or nothing, black or white. If you accept part of a lie, you've accepted it completely because the effect will be the same. If it doesn't impart peace, health, and safety, do not entertain the thought. You tell it, you're fired. The cool part is that as you practice this, it becomes easier to identify thought that isn't truth. The deeply hidden lies and fears that we carry around that aren't readily seen come to light because they become foreign in the middle of our vigilance for God-centered thoughts. When we detect them and eject them, they lose all the life force they ever had, which was the belief you gave them. Something else to consider along these lines is that whatever you are tempted to see in another, even if you're not attempting to fix or help somebody, you are making it true for yourself. For example, say you just saw the beginnings of the signs that they put out for the flu shot for that year's flu season, and you immediately deny the belief of any, quote, season of sickness, and affirm your exemption from any human health laws. You've covered yourself, and you move on without taking further thought about it. But a few days later, you call your friend up who sounds terrible, and she tells you how she got this terrible flu and has been in bed for days. She recounts her symptoms, and you tell her how awful she sounds. You have sympathy for her, and on some level, you think how grateful you are that this isn't happening to you. Bingo! You just took the bait. Hook, line, sinker. Done. If the sickness is real in someone else, then you've accepted its reality and it will play out in you at some point in your future until you handle this claim. Another important one is the one I related to about accidents. We may do prayerful work for ourselves or family members before a trip or vacation, or perhaps on our way to work in the morning. Well, that's half of it, but as you're driving on the road, you become stuck in traffic and you get up to where there's been an auto accident and you slow down and stare and watch, perhaps, as they wheel somebody into an ambulance, and it stirs up emotions of fear and sympathy with the injured person. And you just walked into the dream of car accident and resulting damage, pain, etc. You've made it real, and therefore you are susceptible. Now, I am not advocating that we become callous and indifferent to those who seem to be suffering. We are here to be the love of God, and turning a blind eye to someone in need is not loving. We are to have compassion for everyone. We are to love one another. Jesus felt compassion. Instead of standing aghast at a so-called condition or disease, he healed it. He refused to be pulled into the dream. He stood undivorced from truth and claimed that truth over every circumstance that presented itself. You and I, no matter where we are on our spiritual path, and no matter whether we feel competent to heal another, have the ability and privilege to assert the truth in every situation where we're tempted to see the absence of truth. What truth do you assert? Well, you remove all evidence of the physical senses, as they are clearly incapable of conveying or discerning spiritual truth in existence, and you assert only what perfect, loving, and all-powerful God created. It's usually the direct opposite of what the material scene attempts to portray. In the face of poverty, you assert infinite abundance. In the face of sickness, you declare man's spiritual identity, free from health laws, man's holiness and perfection. In the face of accident, you declare divine mind's unerring government of its ideas. In the face of death, you assert infinite life. In the face of sadness, you assert abounding joy. And when the serpent pops in with, "This is wishful thinking," or accuses you of being blind, you, quote, "rise in the strength of spirit to resist all that is unlike good." Tell it where to go, and know that the truth you are asserting is the light that drives out the darkness. It's truth over error, love over fear, that you are aligning your thought with what is. And that this alignment of your thought with the truth is what sets both you and everyone your thought rests upon free. As you refuse to entertain false beliefs, and as you stand firm in the truth, you'll be inspired by how your life experience is transformed. You'll see the good in your experience that you insist upon. You will experience the blessings and abundance that flows to you as you clear your mind of the ego's chatter and open your thought to the invigorating and inspiring warmth of divine life and love. Those you encounter will sense your elevated thought and respond in kindness and openness. It's awesome. As you practice this, you are stepping into your divinity, your true self with a capital S, the one created in the image and likeness of God, and you experience the joy of returning to the kingdom of heaven that lives within you. I'm so grateful to be on this journey with each of you. You are loved. You are supported. You are divine. Much love to you.
Healing Through Prayer with Corrine Walson is broadcast on PLIR, Prayerful Living Internet Radio.